Blog Talk Radio.
And now, a moment from the Movie Geeks United archive.
We want to get to our next interview with co-star of the film, Jennifer Lawrence. Jennifer is fantastic in this movie. She's the real discovery in this movie. But she is a phenomenon, her performance in this film. And we spoke to Jennifer last week, and this is what she had to say about her experience working on the film.
I'm so moved by you in this movie. You're fantastic in it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Are you good at watching yourself on screen? When you've seen this at various film festivals and screenings and things, are you good about that?
Yeah. I don't. I mean, I learn something every time I watch. You know, I don't think that I should not want to watch something because I'm afraid of, you know, if I have a double chin or how my butt looks, you know, I don't want to be able to, like, not watch myself on screen. It's actually, this is weird. I actually don't think I've ever told anyone this. The weirdest part about the show is when I'm watching myself on screen, I know it's me, but it's not really like watching me. It's like watching just a normal person. It doesn't really affect me that much.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to the first screening and I saw it for the first time, seeing Charlize, it was the most out-of-body experience I've ever had.
When you watch the film at film festivals and things, how has that experience been for you? I know you had a huge victory at Venice. You won an award at Venice last year for this film.
Yeah, yeah. So weird. You would not even believe. Like, first of all of this is happening. I'm going to Italy, and there's, like, huge premieres and everything, and my brother's like, what the hell is going on? All of us were. We're all just, like, rednecks from Kentucky, like, freaking out. And then the premiere ends, and we go back to Kentucky, and then we go to Toronto the next day for the Toronto Film Festival. And that night, I'm getting ready for the Toronto Film Festival, and Guillermo calls me, and he goes, my dear, I have very bad news. And I was like, what? He says, you cannot come tonight. I was like, what? Why? Why can't I come tonight? He goes, you cannot come. You cannot come because you have to fly to Italy because you just won Marcello Mastroianni Award or something. And I was just like, yes, oh, my gosh, what is that? And started freaking out and then got on a plane to Italy or flew to London and then to Italy where it was then daytime. I haven't slept, so I'm probably, like, crazy when I land. And then go walk into this hotel room with, like, beautiful dresses hanging everywhere and, like, shoes lined up. I was like, oh, my gosh, I'm a princess. And then I got ready and got the award, and it was just all so out of body. I can't even describe what that feels like. It's just such an incredible feeling when you work so hard on something and you get recognized for it and appreciated and rewarded.
Our archive clip for tonight's show, that was Jennifer Lawrence in an interview we conducted several years ago before The Hunger Games, before Winter's Bone, for a movie she did called The Burning Plain. And I remember watching that movie at a festival, and she wasn't someone that was offered to us. But I thought she was phenomenal in the movie, so I searched out her publicist and, like, requested her.
You were way ahead of your time on that one. Really.
Yeah, I mean, it's really all my doing, I think.
Yeah,
it's
no,
what
no,
it comes right down to.
It was really, no. I mean, because then you have Winter's Bone and The Hunger Games, and, I mean, you get these two, and there's a lot of Hunger Games sequel casting news this week, and
Yeah.
I didn't know they were making the third. They were going to make the third one into two movies. I had no idea until this week. So everyone's doing this to get as much juice, I guess, as they can out of these.
Yeah. Let me bring on. Hey, Dean, you're on.
Hey.
Hey, man.
Hey, how are you? Good to talk to you.
You know what? I was actually I saw somebody reading one of the Twilight books.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of, you know, literary properties that make tentpole
mm-hmm.
franchises, I had no idea how thick that thing was.
Yeah, no, I mean that's quite a, it's quite a the paperweights and everything. So no, but
offer it's like a teenage vampire thing, and it's like 1,000 pages or something.
It seems that way. Yeah, the last one. I guess you're maybe the last one. Yeah, they are very thick. I wasn't
what
aware
is it,
of
like
that.
Dickens? Yeah,
I think
Charles
first,
Dickens,
think first,
Breaking
first,
Dawn.
The first four letters, obviously, yeah, in Dickens. I'm sure.
A Tale of Two Twilights.
But
it's great. So how are you guys doing? Everything good this
weekend? Yeah, we're
weekend?
Okay. I'm okay.
Yeah, good. Big movie day for me today.
You watched some flicks today?
I did. I went to go see Moonrise Kingdom, just to be a completist about it, you know. Definitely a minor Wes Anderson movie. It's just as I feared, I was a little annoyed by his over art direction of things, you know, like everything's perfectly centered and, you know,
damn that clean framing. I hate that.
He has a particular style about him. I mean,
it's like everything is kind of, I don't know, everything is just kind of ridiculously perfect, kind of in a weird way. It's very difficult to explain, but it felt like self-parody to me. Like it was.
Well, that is. Huge problem with him and also with Whit Stillman, I may add, too. They both, I mean, and you could go with Sofia Coppola after Somewhere in that regard. There is a thinking, you know, you could say that about Wes Anderson. I think the Wes Anderson film you could really say that about that is like a parody of a Wes Anderson film is The Life Aquatic. I think The Life Aquatic is a parody of a Wes Anderson film, more so than any other.
Well, this one definitely felt like it. It was a slight little movie, but my big complaint with it was, my biggest complaint with it was that I didn't think they spent enough time with the two leads, by themselves. I wanted to see more of them just by themselves relating to each other. I thought that we'd gotten very little of that in the movie. I thought there was too much of that,
not in a bad way, I just thought there was a lot of that, but... I just kept, whenever Tilda Swinton came on screen and she's in charge of social services, I almost yelled out in the theater, really? This bitch can't be a mother. Come on, social services? You got to be kidding me.
We really need to talk about Kevin.
Yeah.
That should be the subtitle of Moonrise Kingdom. Moonrise Kingdom, colon. We still haven't talked about it. That'll be the name of the sequel. You know what? With the three filmmakers you mentioned, Wes Anderson, Sofia Coppola, and... What was the other one?
Whit Stillman.
Yes. I find, I just don't, I see that they're very accomplished filmmakers. I have just never been able to gel with their tone. It's just
well,
a disconnect.
Just, they're totally in their own heads, I think.
Yeah.
You know, they're totally unconcerned with, you know, trying different things or anything. They're just, this is what they are. Every movie is going to be this way. And, you know, if you like this kind of movie, you know exactly. It's like buying a box of Tide, I thought, when I got out. It's like, well, you go to a Wes Anderson movie,
but
and this is what you get,
more,
you know.
A box of Tide. Buying a box of Tide, though. I mean, I actually do like Moonrise Kingdom a lot, but I mean, out of the three, I think he's my favorite. It was like, my problem is, like, while watching Damsels in Distress, I couldn't help but think he's been away for so long, and at the same time, it was like, wow, I just feel like I was watching The Last Days of Disco in 1998.
Nothing's changed. I'm sure nothing has changed.
But
I understand it,
and I understand what you mean, Jamie. That's a valid criticism. I mean, that's a valid
and my criticism, I'm actually not even saying that there's a defect in the films, and I'm not saying that there's a defect in me. It's just some voices we respond to more than others, you know? It's just personal.
Yeah, no, of course. Absolutely. Although this one I did like more. I mean, I like. I think this was a very good. He manages to get good performances out of somebody. He really got, I thought, a very good performance out of Bruce Willis in this movie.
He was good in it, but I didn't. But here's my other big complaint with the movie. I didn't think it was funny at all. Like, I never laughed. The only time I laughed was when Jason Schwartzman came on. That was it.
What about? Although I did like when Harvey Keitel. I had no idea Harvey Keitel was in the movie, and then he shows up.
Well,
like, oh my god.
But he only has like two lines in it,
I know,
so
it's
not
like,
really a character.
Oh my god, he's in the movie.
Well, I'm
yeah,
thankful
but
for that.
Yeah, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. But it is, if you don't, I don't. Listen, let me put it to you like this: if you don't, if you haven't gotten into Wes Anderson yet, then this isn't going to convince you. I'll be the first to say that.
So actually, Dean and I saw a movie, Jerry. I don't know if you've caught it yet. It just became available yesterday. Which is Margaret.
You were going to see it this weekend. It's available on the same day as DVD on our demand, so I think we're going to try to watch it this weekend.
Actually, Marguerite, I think, is how, like, the proper
pronunciation. Or Margaret.
Margaret, yeah. Which
yeah.
sounds like a nicotine gum, but okay.
That's quite a gum.
I'd be interested to see it again. I actually saw the theatrical cut. Which one did
that's
you see?
That's the one I watched too. But I'm going to watch the 180-minute version of it
okay,
later on.
Okay, 149 minutes on demand. Oh my god!
Yeah, that's theatrical. Yeah.
That's the theatrical release. The longer version is on.
I'll watch the other version too. But you know, everybody kind of made it clear that. Him especially, Kenneth Lonergan especially, that there's no definitive cut. So I thought, well, then I'll just watch the theatrical, what I have at my disposal
yeah.
right now.
It's not like Alexander, where there'll be like 5 million versions.
So what did you think of it, Jamie?
I don't know.
Oh, really?
I know instantly
I loved it. I loved
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I know you did, but I was not instantly blown away by it. I thought it was... I thought it was very scattershot for me.
I didn't feel that way at all. I felt that everything seemed incredibly real to mm-hmm. me. That I really know people like that. It had a terrific sense of what New York is like, and the sort of sense of looking out of your window in New York and seeing all these lights on and realizing that there are different lives going on in each one of those rooms that you see. And the character, the lead character of Lisa, as we know, as people should know, it's not Margaret who's the lead character. Her name is Lisa. She's played by Anna Paquin. I loved how abrasive she was, but yet she still got me in there caring about her because I could sense a real deep hurt inside of her. And I was wondering if there was going to come a moment where she would realize that it was in there too. And I'm not just talking about the hurt that came from the traumatic event that opens the movie, but just a much deeper hurt, like where she can't really connect to any kind of emotion, whether it's expressed in plays or movies or expressed between two people, you know. She just couldn't connect, and I think that's what the movie's really about. It's about her awakening, you know, into an emotion besides her own sort of kvetching about life and you know, her own
right.
little minor problems, you know.
Right. No, I really admired the conception of that character. It felt very unique, and I think Anna Paquin's pretty sensational in it. And a lot of critiques of the film have actually panned it for that reason. Oh my God, where our lead character is so incredibly annoying and abrasive and so self-involved and. This and that, and I thought that was kind of refreshing. It was a refreshing characterization that I've rarely, if ever, seen in a movie before.
She was
a character you wanted to figure out. So I enjoyed that, but 2.5 hours of it felt aimless to me. I mean,
I didn't feel that way. I love to see movies about just normal people in their lives, you know, dealing with their problems, and this was, I mean,
nobody writes dialogue better.
Well, some people do. Some people don't like to see that.
Well, you know,
kind of thing,
I don't.
So.
But there's content and then there's form. I had no problem with the themes he was exploring, but in terms of his form, I thought that you know, it was it felt too rambling to me. I didn't think that there was a concrete kind of unity of theme in his form. I thought that the whole approach to it, more often than not, worked against what he was trying to get across. I mean, that was that was my complaint. It wasn't content or character or the quality of writing necessarily, in terms of the character. You know,
there was just something about the editing of it. Would you say? I mean, does it come right down to like that? Like just the pacing of it?
Yeah, it could be. I actually read Armand White's review of it today.
Uh-huh.
And of course, he hated it because
I'm sure he loved it. Yeah,
it's deemed a masterpiece by everyone else, so of course he hated it. But I thought he brought up some very good points. You know, he's brought up good points in a couple of his past interviews or reviews that I'm like, what's wrong with me? I'm finding validity in an Armand White review.
Well, he does bring up interesting things, and he's, you know, but sometimes I just think he's just going the other way.
Being a contrarian, actually. Even if it's just for the sake of it, sometimes that does bring up interesting points. I mean, you'll accidentally happen upon interesting points, because if you love a film, you don't necessarily consider the opposite view, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it has its place.
By the way,
sometimes.
By the way, Margaret, didn't you love J. Smith Cameron as her mother? I thought she was terrific in it.
Yes.
And Mark Ruffalo had a couple, you know, his two scenes are really great, and also Jeannie Berlin, who I haven't seen since Heartbreak Kid back in '72. She played the you know, Allison Janney, who's the woman who dies in the beginning of the movie. She plays her best friend, you know. Mm-hmm. And
I think it opens especially well. I think it opens on a very visceral note, because I mean, it's no secret. I mean, if anyone's seen the trailer or read anything about it, the whole engine that starts the movie is a death, like an accidental hit and run, or is it accidental? It's accidental no matter how you paint it. But that death scene was very wrenching, and I credit Allison Janney with a lot of that too, as well as Anna Paquin.
No question about it. That was a great one scene performance, and I really found the ending. Are you still there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I really found the ending like incredibly moving. You know, the ending at the opera house. I cried. I was pretty much blown away by that. So
yeah.
I don't know. It's whatever it is, you have to see it. I mean, if you're a movie lover, you have to see it. If you're not seeing it, you're missing out.
I was very moved by the ending too, and especially with the knowledge that that's the closest I'll ever get to opera. So.
Well, maybe
okay.
Maybe you need to reconsider that.
We have a documentary spotlight tonight. We have two great interviews about two terrific films. I had not seen a lot of documentaries this year. So when I was presented with the opportunity to speak to these two filmmakers and watch their movies, it was a breath of fresh air, because the documentaries that I have seen have not impressed me. But these two films we'll be discussing tonight definitely did. And they belong on my top 10 list of the year so far, without a doubt.
Okay, cool.
And the filmmakers couldn't have been more generous and engaging, and I'm excited to bring these interviews tonight. And then we'll play this first interview, and then we'll come back. We'll talk a little bit about documentaries. Then we'll close off with the last interview. And actually, we have a score premiere that has something to do with the documentary as well.
Oh,
it's
cool.
It all ties in. The Queen of Versailles.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And then Sunday night, I tell you what, we'll do Sunday night. We'll come. We'll just do a general movie news roundtable thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we premiere Hans Zimmer's Dark Knight Rises score that night, too. So.
Oh, okay, cool.
Good stuff. Let's get to our first interview. Imposter, The Imposter. This is one of the most acclaimed movies so far this year. It premiered at Sundance, and it captured raves. And you're going to, speaking of top 10 lists, I'm sure you're going to see it on a ton of them. The Imposter is an unbelievable true story about this family in San Antonio, Texas in 1994. Their son turned up missing. I believe their son was 13 years old. 3 years later, a French con man convinced this family that he was their missing son. And they bought it. And so it's about, you know, how he was able to do that, how he was able to fool everyone, how he was able to do that morally, why the family chose to believe him, because he wasn't like the son at all. There's an element of maybe they were so desperate to have their son back that they would believe anything. They could convince themselves of anything. You might think that, but then there's a third act twist in this true story that changes everything that came before it. This is a truly surprising, very thrilling documentary. It plays like a thriller. And I spoke earlier today with the director of the film, Bart Layton, and the producer, Dimitri Douganis. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And here they are talking about Imposter on the other side. I'll tell you where you can see the film for yourself. Here they are.
The birthday girl, isn't she beautiful? And here is her brother, Nick.
The thought of what somebody could have done to him, it gives you nightmares. Just gotta go get him and get him back here where he's safe.
I didn't see how I could not document him as a U.S. citizen.
We had no idea what kind of person we were getting. He looked very different.
He disappeared without a trace 3 years ago. Tonight, a San Antonio boy is back home.
When a child is missing for years, either the child is dead or the child is not found.
He was tortured. I mean, he had torture written on.
This kid's really messed up.
There was just something wrong about it.
Something was being hidden, and I didn't know what that was.
The FBI is not taking this case lightly.
There was something going on more than meets the eye, of course.
He couldn't speak English without an accent.
Maybe it's not Nicholas Barclay.
He cannot be an American.
We didn't need to prove who he was.
This is their family member. I mean, no one would be wrong about something like that.
Wait a minute. What has he done?
This is a very dangerous person.
The story is so bizarre, it's hard to believe it's true. Him.
What interests me about making documentaries in general is that you could have one idea of what you think your documentary will be when you start, and it can kind of evolve into something completely different by the time you're through with it. And I would think that this might particularly be the case with this one, because you're dealing with so many twists and turns and people that you're not quite sure of their ultimate motivations. Did you find that was the case to you? Did it kind of evolve during the process of shooting it into something different than you had originally expected it to be?
Yeah, I think that is probably a fair comment and a good observation. I mean, I think certainly part of the process of making the film was a very unusual one in that, you know, there were certainly times when we felt like we were in our own detective story in one respect. And I suppose what I mean by that is that, you know, we were confronted with various different and often conflicting versions of the same events. And you would go from one interview one day convinced that you knew exactly what had happened and how this situation had come about, to another interview the next day with someone from a different side of the story, and you'd come away with a completely opposite conclusion. And that really felt like something that was very important to try and reflect in the structure of the film, so that the audience would be able to experience some of that slightly bewildering journey that we went on.
So the ultimate kind of motivation with this was not necessarily to find a definitive truth, obviously, but to present these different sides and kind of be as objective about it as possible?
Yeah, Jamie, I think that's right. I think we knew fairly early on that we weren't going to be able to tell or to answer the story of what had happened to Nicholas Barclay, although that would have been amazing to be able to do that. So what we're left with is a series of events which everyone kind of agrees on what the events are, but they give them completely different meaning and completely different context. And so what you have is a story, instead of where a classic documentary where you're laying out an objective truth that has been kind of rigorously researched and you set that out as clearly and concisely as possible. Instead, what you have here is overlapping and competing accounts of the same series of events. And in a way, that's what makes it so interesting. Mm-hmm. It's about giving these competing and conflicting subjective accounts a way to exist in the same film together and make sense. And for the audience to go on something of the same ride that we did, which was going from, as Bart says, one of these accounts or one of these interviews or one of these research calls, thinking you understood what happened, to then going to hearing another person's account and suddenly that being stood on its head and thinking, oh my God, that's not what I thought, that's not what happened at all. It's completely different. Well, that's not why that person did that at all. So it was a really quite amazing journey, the uncovering of the story and the really getting to grips with the story. And I think it's a journey which hopefully the audience gets to go on as well in the course of the film.
That's what I find most fascinating about it as well, that dynamic. But I'm curious to know, was there any difficulty in getting any of the participants involved in the film?
It was time consuming to get all of the participants on board, because I think particularly from the family's point of view, you know, they had a couple of experiences where, so for example, there was a very detailed article which they contributed to in the New Yorker magazine, and I think they felt that they hadn't come off well and they were hesitant to repeat the experience. I think because most people's immediate feeling is one which is quite negative towards them, because really, you know, how could you mistake a French Algerian man with brown eyes and brown hair and a thick French accent for your blonde blue-eyed boy, especially when he was 23 and the boy who had gone missing would have been 17. And so I think people generally find that an incredibly difficult thing to comprehend. And so I think they felt they didn't want to put themselves in the firing line. But at the same time, I think they also felt that there were things that they wanted to have the opportunity to tell their side of the story in a way that they hadn't previously. And really that's all we were asking for from them, you know, that they would tell an incredibly detailed account of their experience or their side of the story, and that was really all we were asking for. And I think they felt that was something that they needed to do, or that they wanted to do ultimately.
Well, and I found it a very interesting psychology, because I did get the feeling that they were so committed to wanting their boy back that they were willing to believe anything. And at the same time, that might not be the case because of another twist in the story. But in terms of the imposter himself, I mean, you're dealing with the kind of the very definition of an unreliable narrator here.
Absolutely. I mean, isn't that what makes, in a way, this so interesting? You know, here is a story where your central witness. You know, as an audience, and kind of as a filmmaker, but as an audience, you know from the very opening frames of the film, in fact, from the very title of the film, that this person is an imposter, a liar, not to be trusted. And yet, this is the person who kind of leads you through these events, and that's in a way, I think, what makes it so intriguing. He looks you in the eye and tells you his story, and he is kind of compelling and at times sympathetic, and mm-hmm. at times you find yourself rooting for this person who is doing these terrible things. And I think in a way you have to, you know, part of the reason the film works is because he is a manipulator of human emotion and in a way a brilliant one. And he does to the audience a version of what he has done to the State Department, the Children's Home in Spain, the FBI, various news organizations, etc., which is kind of weave this spell around himself and his justifications, and the audience gets an amazing insight into that, I think, because he is this completely unreliable witness who you know is unreliable from the beginning, and there he is in front of you.
Well, I love that quality in narrative films as well. And so I think you're absolutely right. That's what really works about the documentary in terms of his participation. But did you ever feel a level of comfort with him? Did you spend a lot of time with him previous to interviewing him to establish some kind of rapport?
I didn't really. In fact, normally I think, you know, I would choose to spend, you know, more time with a contributor before interviewing, just so that you kind of, you know, you arrive at an understanding. With Frederick, I didn't really want to. I mean, yes, of course, I spent time with him before the actual interview itself, but I certainly didn't want, you know, what I wanted was to kind of allow him to tell the story in such a way as that he would tell it to someone who wasn't necessarily, you know, closely connected to him, to someone that he would, you know, I kind of wanted to be in the position of, in a similar position to how the audience would be, which is that, you know, allowing him to work his magic, or you know, for want of a better word. I think
mm-hmm.
we spent two long days doing those interviews, and I felt that there was a certain, not, I mean, objectivity, but a certain distance required, because I think, you know, when you do spend time with him, you become aware that he can be very charming, he can invite sympathy, and he can be you know, it's quite a complicated series of emotions that you go through in dealing with him, and you find yourself at times sort of beginning to understand what is a rather twisted logic, you know, which is his idea that, you know, they were a family without a child and I was a child without a family. And of course, that's a preposterous thought. But when he tells you it, you kind of think, you find yourself thinking, well, maybe. And then at the moment you find yourself realizing that you're kind of falling for that logic, you realize that perhaps you're falling for the con and the manipulation in exactly the same way. And so, as Dimitri was just saying a moment ago, that was something that we wanted the audience to be able to experience, you know. And again, it comes back to this idea of trying to create a film where you, as the audience, are kind of inside the story rather than kind of hovering above it, you know, looking at it through a microscope, if you know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean. And that quality, you know, it's obviously a documentary, but it plays like a thriller. And
that was something that we really wanted. That was very much something that we felt. I don't think every documentary or every story offers that possibility, and I certainly don't think every documentary really warrants the kind of treatment, both visually and structurally that we've given to this film, but I think this story certainly does motivate it. And we also felt that, you know, there's the potential to create a film here that would play to audiences that might not go to see a documentary in the cinema. You know, I think we felt that, you know, the story could play like a thriller because the experience of making it was full of so many twists and turns, just in terms of the discoveries of doing the interviews, that, you know, what I wanted to do was create a structure that reflected that experience, you know, that we talked a little bit about, where your sympathy and your notion of the truth is constantly shifting.
Well, in terms of some of these devices that you use during the course of the film, I mean, they're not reenactments, because you say reenactments and it brings to mind, you know, something cheesy like an Unsolved Mysteries episode, but they're more kind of very polished, almost subliminal images, setups placed within the film. What was the thinking behind inserting those?
I'm really, it's incredibly gratifying to hear you describe them in that way, because I think you kind of grasped exactly what the film is trying to convey. You know, the use of those dramatized sequences is not a reenactment in the classic sense, and I don't think either of us really love that word, reenactment, which suggests that you are kind of faithfully recreating what had happened. You know, here you've got, as we were talking earlier, these competing versions of events. And, you know, when someone tells you about their experiences or their memories, you have a kind of movie that plays in your head. And I think that what happened with the recreations was, or the dramatizations, was that they are done to, you know, what you're watching there is not a single objective fact. What you're watching is this Persian's version of events. So you're watching a subjective account. And if you look at those sequences carefully, you'll see that each of those sequences starts over one person's shoulder, or each of those sequences starts kind of following someone's feet into a room or with someone's point of view. And they're all shot slightly on an odd frame rate and in this very kind of floaty way. So yeah. you have these signals which tell the audience, hey, this is what this person claims happened. And what you watch as the film progresses and as the mystery unfolds is these different versions of these events unfolding in these different people's memories and these different people's accounts of it.
Last question for you. There's so much gray in the film. I mean, there's not a lot of black and white here, because there's so many different versions of what actually occurred and the motivations behind what occurred. But when you gave birth to this to an audience on the festival circuit, from their reactions, what surprised you the most about how they reacted to it?
That's another really good question, Jamie. I mean, one of the things that actually I think surprised me the most with an American audience, given that we had played it kind of to small British audiences prior to Sundance, was there was a lot of laughter actually in the audience at Sundance, and that was something that really took me by surprise. And I think possibly something, you know, some of that is to do with, you know, there being kind of different cultural sort of reference points for Americans. You know, I think there's a temptation for them to laugh at their fellow countrymen in a way that we in the UK maybe aren't aware of some of those stereotypes or some of those things. So that was certainly something that really surprised me. I mean, of course, there are certain things in the film which are intentionally, you know, humorous. You know, Charlie Parker is a character that is straight out of a kind of Coen Brothers film and you know, does say some things which are very comic. But certainly there are other things which weren't intended to be humorous at all and occasionally elicit great laughter. And so that was something that was surprising to me.
Yeah. Well, you guys have made a terrific, beautiful movie, and I congratulate you guys on it, and thanks so much for giving me time today.
Oh, listen, it's a complete pleasure, Jamie, and you've asked some really brilliant questions.
judge insisted on separate interviews, and part of the evidence that was in those interviews was a family photo album.
And the judge said, listen, the only way for you to prove that it's you really Nicholas, we got pictures here that you've never seen before. I'm going to show you five of them. Number one, okay. Number two, okay. Number three, okay. And number four, okay. On the five one, I made a mistake.
Okay, that is director Bart Layton and producer Dimitri DeGaynis. The film is The Imposter. It opens this Friday in New York. It opens August 3rd in Los Angeles and other locations in California. And the rest of the country, the major cities, throughout the month of August. So that's where you can look for that particular film. It's a great, intriguing movie. Highly recommended. Okay, documentaries, guys. Let's do some documentary talk. Let's actually start where we normally finish.
Okay.
And maybe this can inspire some conversation. I have, guess what I have?
Yes. What is it?
What do you have?
Oh, come on, guys. I'm so predictable. I have a list. I have a...
Oh, okay. No, I thought you meant like you had like something like gonorrhea.
I knew what it was.
Syphilis, yeah. No, that's what I got. Let's see a documentary on that. So let's go through Time Out through their top 20 best documentaries of all time, and this can inspire some conversation. Did you guys see, their number 20 is actually a really another very intriguing movie from a very intriguing filmmaker, Tony Kaye.
Mm-hmm.
Their number 20 is Lake of Fire, the epic abortion documentary.
No, I want to see it.
I've never seen that.
I want to see it. I just haven't gotten around to it. But
that, I think it's on DVD. It might be out of print, so I think it's probably more expensive than usual.
Right, okay.
Because I was interested in watching it again. It was interesting. I mean, this movie, if I remember correctly, it's over 3 hours long. And it was made in 2006. And you think to yourself, you know, what new thing is there to say about the abortion argument, debate?
Mm-hmm.
And the movie doesn't really have anything new to say. Its value is that this is really actually an objective documentary that gives equal time to both sides of the argument, and you never feel as if it's judging for itself which side to fall on.
Mm-hmm.
Which is was his intention in making the documentary. The thing that really distinguishes it, and this is a deal breaker for a lot of people, I'm sure, that might think of watching it, is it shows an actual abortion at the end of it.
Yeah. Well, I guess you have to have it, you know.
It is necessary, especially, I mean, you feel like it's necessary, especially as exhaustive as this movie is.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what we're talking about is ultimately what it comes down to.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's an interesting movie. And I know that we've all three seen their number 19 pick, which is The Times of Harvey Milk. We've
mm-hmm.
talked to that filmmaker about
right,
it.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's still brilliant. I still love it. I still think that, you know, it totally trumps the narrative film, Milk.
Yeah.
You know, it's 1,000 times better.
I would agree with you
yeah.
on that. Well, this is one of my favorites, Hearts of Darkness.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best movie behind the scenes, just a movie documentaries ever made, without a doubt.
Yeah,
I think,
no question
yeah,
about it.
I think so, too. And just, you know, I can, if I get the Apocalypse Now box set, I'm more likely to watch the documentary first, you know.
Holy shit, I have that. Blu-ray. Oh, yeah. I own that. Okay, yeah. Never mind.
I haven't purchased it yet, but I've been meaning to. But
I've got a copy of it on VHS. So.
I do,
yeah,
too.
I do, too. So
I had a special order my VHS copy years ago because it was long out of print.
And Dean, you'll like this. Stop Making Sense at number 17.
Good choice.
That's good. Very good. Got to be up there. It's funny, some people don't consider concert movies to be documentaries. They pigeonhole documentaries as being, you know, talking heads, you know, like literally talking heads movies, you know, where people are being interviewed and stuff. But no, it's a concert movie is just as much of a documentary as anything else.
Yeah. Kitty Cat Follies, number 16.
Well, I'm sorry, what was that?
That's in my top 10. Kitty Cat Follies.
Yeah.
Have you seen that, Jared?
No, I have. Well, I didn't hear the title. I didn't hear the...
It's called Titicut Follies.
I've heard of it. I've never seen it. What is it about? What is?
It's,
you just wanted us to say tit again.
Yeah.
It's Frederick Wiseman's first movie done in 67 about the insane asylum, you know, and how, you know... conditions in a particular insane asylum.
That sounds fascinating.
Oh, it's great, but it's hard to watch.
1967 is when it came out. It was met with a 24-year ban on public screenings.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was, yeah. But it changed a lot of things. I think it had a major ripple effect throughout the entire industry.
That's how you know that you've hit a nerve, when they can ban your movie for 24 years.
Yeah.
You're doing something right.
It's true.
Crumb, number 15.
Oh, that's
Crumb.
That's a great one.
Yeah. That's number 11 on my list. I have my list in front of me, my top 101 documentaries. That's number 11 on my list.
Number 14.
Great movie.
Number 14, I've seen this. Hearts and Minds.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you talk about the treatment of Vietnam in film,
mm-hmm.
and we think in terms of the narrative films. I mean, Hearts and Minds was definitely one of the very first out of the gate.
Yeah. No, it's very important film.
I think the only one, there's only a couple that might have beat it, and that's the interviews with My Lai veterans. It was done by Joseph Strick in 1970, I think. And then there was In the Year of the Pig, done by Emil D'Antonio in the mid-60s. That's really the first one, because it gets in there like before we've even thrown all our chips in, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's talking about mainly the French conflict and sort of the run-up to war. So.
And that won the Best Documentary Oscar.
Right.
That year, too. Man, my voice just got really deep. Do you notice that?
Yeah, I was
it's very white
that,
deep.
Man, I'm going to do the show like this from now on. This is Sexy Movie Geeks United. I'm going to use my sexy voice, which is probably the only time that this has ever happened when this movie has been mentioned. The number 13 greatest documentary of all time is Triumph of the Will.
That's an important film. I've never heard it introduced like that, but yeah, I mean, you just you just watched that. It's a fascinating
how
film.
How do you there was years ago, I know that Jodie Foster was interested in playing Leni Riefenstahl in a film, a biopic. I mean, just absolutely grandiose filmmaking.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way around it. I mean, regardless of what, you know, it is watching both of those films. I mean, and there's a documentary that came out about her, I think in the early 90s that I found.
Called The Wonderful, Horrible Life of Leni Riefenstahl.
So Jodie Foster, that's right, Jodie Foster did want to play her. What part was Mel Gibson going to have in the film? I guess this would be the prequel to The Beaver.
He would be Hitler.
That would be obvious, yeah.
He would be perfect. Inspired.
But it's extraordinary filmmaking, and it's clearly a propaganda film.
Oh, yeah. Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, it is. No question about it. I mean, it is. I mean, it has the whole power of the Reich behind it, literally.
You have two of the greatest propaganda films. Actually, three of the greatest propaganda films coming out of this. You have the Triumph of the Will, but also in Russia, Soviet Union, you have Alexander Nevsky, which may be the greatest pro-war film ever made, and you have I've Been a Terrible's Part 1 and 2. And remember,
exactly.
I think it was going to be a part three, too, but that we never got that never happened. But
you could also
maybe
throw in there Riefenstahl's Olympia.
Oh,
Olympia
is very important. I was gonna. That's a very important film. I mean,
well, and you know, they didn't do the third Ivan the Terrible, but I heard they were considering a reboot.
Well, you know, there is a reboot of Alexander Nevsky. They remade Alexander. The Russians remade. I guess Putin wanted it remade. There is a remake of Alexander Nevsky. I don't know if it's available here yet or not, but on DVD. But they did remake it.
I think it'd be very interesting to see the story of Ivan the Terrible redone, though. That would be fascinating.
Yes, no, I agree. I agree 100%. I would love that.
I find the Eisenstein movies to be a little difficult to watch because they're so overblown.
They're overblown, but they have a great scores though. They have awesome.
They do.
Nothing beats the Sam Raimi original for me.
That's true. That's very true. You're
Ivan the Terrible.
Yeah.
Number 12, Werner Herzog. Just a matter of time before he pops up. Guess what movie
yep.
is?
Grizzly Man?
Grizzly yeah. Man.
Yes.
That's it. That's definitely his best documentary. I'm a big fan of... he's got three movies on my list. Little Dieter Needs to Fly.
Mm-hmm.
And also... I really loved Encounters at the End of the World.
That's a good one.
What's the one that is it Fitzcarraldo or is it the
well,
Ship of Dreams? Well, that's no, Something
that
of Dreams.
Bird of Dreams and that's
Bird of Dreams
blank.
Is great though. Oh my God, that's a great. But
yeah.
That's not him though. That's another one that you could put up there with Hearts of Darkness. That's a great thing about making movies.
Oh, Burden
yeah.
of Dreams isn't Werner Herzog?
No, it's about
no, it's,
him, but he didn't direct it, though.
It's
oh,
Les
I see.
Blank.
Man,
Les
Werner
Blank.
Herzog is fascinating.
Oh, he is.
He got shot during an interview. Do you guys know that? He was doing
yeah.
an interview, and
wind,
a stray bullet hit him. I don't think it was intended for him. It just, like, out of nowhere, he was sitting on a balcony doing an interview, and his body felt the impact of a stray bullet.
Documentary on Klaus Kinski is great too, though. My Best Fiend. I love that.
Oh, My Best Fiend. That is terrific.
That's
no
hilarious.
Question, yeah.
I didn't see the Death Row thing that he just.
I
did.
Haven't seen that yet either. I need to watch.
I saw that and that was good too. That was good too. Not one of his best, but I mean even Herzog's least best is like better than 10 million other filmmakers. So.
And if you're a big fan of artier fare, of fair that's outside of the mainstream, and you're groaning about the next Tom Cruise movie where he plays Jack Reacher, just be comforted in the fact that Werner Herzog plays the villain in that movie.
Well, that should be a wild
movie.
That should be a wild movie anyway.
No, I mean, he really does. Yeah, that'll be great.
That'll be awesome.
Yeah.
I mean,
inspired that choice.
Yeah.
Number 11, Salesman.
That's my number one pick. I think
mm-hmm.
that's the greatest documentary that's ever been made. I just
door-to-door Bible salesman in the 50s or 60s or 50s.
Yeah, 60s.
Okay.
Like
I said,
that's still available. That's a Criterion, isn't it?
Yes,
it
that's
is.
On Criterion.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't Triumph of the Will on Criterion too?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that. But definitely Salesman and Grey Gardens both are on
mm-hmm.
Criterion.
Oh, yeah,
but
definitely,
that's Albert and David Maisels and Charlotte Zwerin are the filmmakers there. Boy,
yeah.
They're great.
Number 10, Man with a Movie Camera.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
also in my top 10. It's number 8.
Wow, they're really going all out here.
They really are. Yeah,
yeah
I mean, this
yeah.
is a smart list.
Yeah. Definitely. You know, the great thing about Man with the Movie Camera is it's one of those, it's a great silent film for this. You could take any piece of music, cut the sound down, you know, don't use their music that they slap on it. Cut the sound down, put any piece of music to it, and it seems like it was made for that piece of music because of its rhythmic editing and everything.
Huh.
It's really the progenitor of the whole, you know, the quote-unquote MTV style of editing.
Right.
I mean, it was already done way back in 29. So.
29, yeah.
Ziga Vertov.
Does it have a VJ in it? Who was the VJ in it?
I think it's got Julie Brown in it.
Okay, let's go.
Number nine, the highest ranking Michael Moore film on their list, Roger and Me.
Yeah, you have to have that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's lower on my list. I mean, I feel like Roger Moore, you know, my love of Roger Moore has waned over the years in some ways.
Michael Moore.
Because,
Michael Moore, not Roger
Michael
Moore.
Moore. Michael Moore. That's probably happened to him a million times. Michael Moore's, my love for him has waned because I don't like what the popularity of his movies has done to the documentary genre as a whole. I feel like a lot of people are out there trying to imitate him. That said, I mean, Roger and Me and a few other of his movies are just indispensable.
Yeah. I'd love to actually talk to him about filmmaking. I've never read a single damn interview with him where he talks about filmmaking.
That's true. That's very true, Jamie.
And what the hell does he do for a living?
That is so true. That would be such a refreshing interview to hear him talk about just making movies instead of political things.
But then again, maybe he doesn't want to. Number eight, Nanook of the North, 1922.
Wow, they're really going like all out far back. I mean,
Robert Flaherty. Yeah. Yeah, you got to have that on the list. I mean, that kind of invented the genre pretty much. So
yeah.
You have to have it.
Number seven, 1965, a masterpiece of what-if storytelling, a chilling feature depicting the aftermath of a British nuclear war from a You Are There perspective. It's called The War Game.
Yeah, that's amazing. Of course, we've talked about this filmmaker on the show. I'm a big, huge fan of this filmmaker. His name is Peter Watkin. He's British. And he's the difficulty about The War Game is that it's not technically a documentary in the sense that everything in it is staged, so it's done in a documentary style. I have it on my list, but I'm thinking about taking it off because all of his movies are done in a documentary style, whether it be the movie he did about Edvard Munch or Punishment Park or the movie I talked about during our war movie segment. A few weeks ago, the Battle of Culloden. They're all done, in this sort of dispassionate documentary style, but they're not documentaries. They're done with actors, and they're written and so forth. So, I don't know. It's but The War Game is a great movie, no question about it. And it
number
did win the Oscar that year.
It did, 1966 Oscar. Number six, Bob Dylan. Hey!
Yeah.
That's my impression for the night. You want another impression? I was watching The Dark Knight tonight because I've been brushing up on the Chris Nolan Batman movies. And then I was thinking of the Dark Knight Rises trailer. Has Michael Caine become more cockney? And that one line that he has in the trailer, I promised my own father that I would look out for you.
There's five trailers. A fifth trailer debuted yesterday.
It's what the hell is we?
That's craziness. I'm glad I haven't seen but one of them.
This, like we said, this thing's pre-sold. You guys have it. You guys own this rest of the summer, pretty much. What are you worried about?
Yeah. Tuesday morning, I get to see it. So that'll be. I'm excited.
Cool.
But the Bob Dylan documentary. It's Don't Look Back, right?
Right. Right. I'm sorry. I got to stop segueing.
That's the D.A. Pennebaker thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's amazing.
You guys like the Scorsese Dylan documentary? No Direction Home?
I love the Scorsese one, but the Pennebaker one is the king.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, and that captures him at a certain period in his life.
Right.
67, that can't be replicated,
Yeah. And there's an interesting a companion documentary with Don't Look Back called Eat the Document that was released a couple of years later. That's really almost just as good, really. It's culled from the same batch of footage, but there was so much of it that they made two documentaries out of it. So Eat the Document is if you like Don't Look Back, you might as well go see the document as well.
Number 5, 1976, Harlan County, USA.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
Yeah, Barbara Topple.
Yeah.
She won the Oscar for that year, and then
Kentucky coal mine strike.
Mm-hmm. And then she won an Oscar in the 80s for a movie called American Dream, which is also great about union. And it's actually a much harsher movie than Harlan County, USA. And it's about the union clashes at a Hormel meatpacking plant.
I remember that. Yeah.
And it's actually a much harsher movie, like a much more disturbing.
What year was Norma Rae? Norma Rae was
79.
Okay. Number 4, Night and Fog. I think this is a movie that's actually Criterion. Holocaust documentary. It's a half hour short.
Right? Yeah, I remember that. We watched that in high school, actually.
Alan Renee.
Well, it was a happy day in high school.
We never got to see the sorrow and the pity, though, in high school.
Couldn't we play something more optimistic, like Macbeth or something?
We saw that, too, in high school.
I remember being shown Macbeth in high school, and it was the Polanski version.
Oh, that was great. We watched that. That was great.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a pretty bloody movie to be showing at high school. That's pretty crazy. They didn't know what they were putting in, did they? They didn't know it.
We had the most senile English teacher, and she didn't know what was going on around her. One day, I convinced her, "Can I show the class a movie?" And she said, "Sure. This is like Anything Goes Day." It was near the end of the school year. I said, "Okay, great." And I had The Shining in my backpack. She had no idea. She was sitting at her desk, and you know, all the kids were loving it. She couldn't see the screen because it was in front of her desk, and it was it. That bathroom scene was amazing. I was a hero for a day in high school.
They're carrying you out of there on their shoulders. That's
and little did I know, one day I was going to interview that naked woman. It's full circle.
Yes.
Number 3, The Thin Blue Line, Errol Morris.
That definitely changed documentaries, I think, you know. Although I don't see, you know, it's funny, I don't see a lot of people really trying to imitate Errol Morris. Not in films, but on television you see it quite a bit.
Well, especially when it comes to the Thin Blue Line. I mean, you see it in every, we mentioned in the previous interviews, you see it in every freaking unsolved mystery Dateline report.
Yeah.
But I tell you the one thing that Errol Morris gave us in terms of documentaries that has been picked up by pretty much every single documentary made since is the camera rig that he invented, where he with the interview subjects actually looking at the pretty much at the camera that allowed them to do that in an interview setting.
Yeah.
I mean, that changed it in a very real way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, I mean, is that something that he's patented? I know he's patented it, but is that something that he's actually sold to other people, to other filmmakers, or is that something that he's, is that?
I don't know how he did that.
But you know who did
that with him?
Who?
Bob Richardson.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. That's interesting.
Because he worked with Morris for a couple of times.
I don't know if you guys have ever seen Errol Morris's television show that he did called First Person, but it's pretty good. I think he did it for IFC. A lot of the time in that show, you can see him. You can kind of get a glimpse of what that device is. Because there's like a big screen over the, I guess it's over the camera lens, right above it, that has his face on it. So it's basically like it's basically like Errol Morris if he had like a camera in his stomach or something, you know. That's basically what it is, you know.
It's Errol Morris doing a colonoscopy, which I'm sure the interview subjects kind of feel that way about it too.
Yeah.
I just rewatched The Fog of War. Was on Encore the other night.
I like that film a lot. I think it's a very good documentary.
I mean,
definitely on my top 100. Yeah.
You couldn't have a better subject, a more relevant subject than McNamara. You know, and you know what a life, and a life that we're still feeling the impact of. I think I can't imagine a time where we won't feel the impact of that in this country. You know,
I'm a big fan of his movie Dr. Death. Remember that?
That's a crazy movie.
I'm a big fan. I think that's after Fog of War, and of course I'm also a huge. I mean, on my list, he's got five movies on the list. He's the top next to the Maisels. I'm a huge fan of Gates of Heaven about the Pet Sematary.
Roger Ebert's favorite movie. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also Vernon, Florida, which was his follow up to that.
You know, I do much prefer Dr. Death over Dr. Detroit, I gotta tell you.
So much for the Dr. Detroit sequel.
Yeah. Number two, Sans Soleil, 1983.
That's,
have you heard of this
that's
one?
Another movie on the list that I've yet to see. That's
enthralling globe hopping essay, which is perhaps the finest first person documentary ever made. We're following a world traveler as he journeys between locations from San Francisco to Africa, from Iceland to Japan. A female narrator speaks over the images as if they were letters home, even though the episodes play out right in front of us. Each viewer is bound to have their own favorite segments. That's interesting. I wonder how you can find that.
I think that's on Criterion, too, I believe.
Really? Okay.
That's Chris Marker, who also did La Jetée, which is not a documentary, the thing that 12 Monkeys is based on.
Right.
And I think they're both on Criterion on the same disc.
Any guess what their number one is?
Monterey Pop or Gimme Shelter, maybe. Sorrow and the Pity.
Woodstock.
Wow.
No?
Showa.
Showa.
Of course.
You know, Showa is a movie that I have to say I respect more than I love, because I respect it because it's a, you know, it's a great document. It's probably the ultimate document of, you know, no one could ever make a Holocaust movie like it ever again.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I have to say, it's, you know, it's like 7 hours long or whatever, and it is a trudge to get through it because, you know, Landsman is French, and he's talking to a Polish person. So Landsman asks his question in French, and then you hear a translator translate it in Polish. Then you get the subtitle. Then you get the Polish answer without the subtitle, and then the French translator translates it back, and then you get the subtitle. So you see how that thing is like, it's twice as long as it needs to be. So it's like, it's
a
real
tough movie. A lot of suspense there.
But it's a hard movie to say, ah, that piece of crap or whatever. I mean, come on. You know,
well, there is one person that said that. And it's her most
Polly
controversial
like
review. Yeah. Polly Kael got hell for her review of Showa. I mean, they were calling for her being fired.
You know, I went back and read that review, and it wasn't, obviously it's a better review than mine, but when I was reviewing movies back in college, I would go see that and reviewed it. And I had basically the same comments, you know, the same kind of feeling that she had about it, too. You know, I mean, I'm glad that she was brave enough to come out and say something, you know, as controversial as that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So
what, you know, I know a documentary that I'm particularly fond of is Capturing the Friedmans.
That's a good one.
That's in my top 20 for sure.
I would have to say for me, Riding Giants, and that's, you know, it's one of my favorite documentaries, and the corporation.
Is that the perfect
The surfing one, yeah. I love I think Riding Giants. And the one before that that Stacy Peralta did, Dogtown and Z-Boys. Awesome. Both of those I love a lot. The Corporation, I think, is very good. And then the one Bukowski Born into This, and then the more recent one, Gonzo. I mean, those were all documentaries I really like a lot. And the Katrina Friedman's is great, Jamie. That's an awesome, wonderful,
film. One of the movies that is usually in most people's top five, they have it outside of their top 20, which is Hoop Dreams.
That's another one. Yeah, that's a great, great film.
I'd like to speak up for a couple that I didn't hear. My second favorite documentary of all time came from '79. It's by Ira Wall. It won the Oscar that year. It's called Best Boy. It's the filmmaker's cousin is. It's a movie about the filmmaker's cousin who's a mentally challenged guy in his mid-50s, still living with his parents that are in their late 80s. They're about to pass away. And the filmmaker goes and tries to get them to let their son go out and try and be on his own, you know, even though he's severely challenged.
Right.
That movie is just devastating. And also Robert Drew's Primary, which is about the 1960 presidential campaign.
Right.
And also Crisis, which was about the Kennedy brothers trying to deal with the whole Alabama school desegregation thing going on with George Wallace and so forth in the middle of their reign at the White House. Point of Order, Emil D'Antonio's sort of redemption of the McCarthy hearing that came out in the mid-60s is also just great. I mean, to take, you know, a thing that's 15 hours of footage and get it down to 90 minutes and make it a coherent, you know, a coherent dramatic story is really an achievement.
Well, my number one documentary, and, you know, we won't talk about it, it just bears mentioning, is the Up series.
Those have to be, yeah.
For me, there's nothing more kind of important in terms of what film is. They have, here's a couple of other titles, When We Were Kings, The Ali.
Great film. I love that film.
And here's probably one of the most unique pseudo-documentaries ever. F for Fake, Orson Welles.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's a good choice. That's one I should I should toy with actually putting on my list, because I do love that movie, and it's a lot of fun.
Another Criterion title.
Another one. I'm sorry.
Oh, right.
I've seen a lot of documentaries. Not this year. I think the most recent documentary I've seen this year is First Position about the ballet.
Uh-huh.
That was good. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what else I've seen as far as documentaries go this year. That's the most recent one I've seen.
I dated a lot of ballet dancers in high school, actually, because we had a dance department at the art school.
Mm-hmm.
And I got them in every position, really. So it's terrible.
Oh,
I'm
my
sorry.
God. There was
Metallica. The Metallica, speaking of music documentaries, some kind of monster.
Great. That's an eye-opening film.
That's a pretty, I've never seen it. It's a pretty unflattering portrayal of those guys, isn't it?
The Paradise Lost series.
Paradise Lost, they don't have on their list.
Yeah. So you got to have that. Definitely Capturing the Friedmans, like you mentioned. And also, for me, you have to have the two Ross McElwee movies, Sherman's March and Time Indefinite. I think they kind of go
they
together.
Have,
and
they have Sherman's March.
I wasn't The War Room.
The War Room isn't on here either, which I thought was on. I just rewatched that probably in the past year. I rewatched it.
That's a and, great film.
It's really something to watch now. It makes you know, if you were supportive of him, especially, it makes you very wistful. Another one that I like from years ago, and we've talked about it on the show, was American Teen. I always liked that movie. And then one of the more recent documentaries that got a lot of acclaim in the past
4 or so years as Man on Wire. And
there's
a moment, and I did watch his other movie, The Project Nim, his
follow-up.
Well,
I still got to watch that.
I've seen that too.
There's a moment in Man on Wire, I know I've talked about it before, but it's kind of this indescribable moment that just, it's hard to articulate, but emotionally I completely understood the moment. It's when they're all looking up and he's walking the wire, and his girlfriend at the time, that they had such a passionate affair at the time, she was looking up at him and crying because she thought the image of him up there resting on the high wire between the World Trade Center towers was so overwhelmingly beautiful. And she had an understanding at that point that their relationship was over. That was it.
Wow.
That's the end of that cycle of their love affair. And it's not something that you can really articulate the meaning of, but I feel it. I understand it emotionally, what she's saying, you know?
That's good. Another good filmmaking one is Lost in La Mancha. You know, that's a great...
Yes, which is
really
off again. I just read a new interview with Gilliam, and he says, no, my Man of La Mancha film is postponed again, or my Don Quixote film is postponed again for another year, at least. A guy, man.
That is going to be one hell of a windmill for that guy to slay, I'm telling you. I guess he's just going to keep on at it.
But at least they finished the documentary, for God's sake. I mean, come on.
Yeah, at least. I want to mention some really obscure documentaries that are on my list. One's actually by a friend of mine, but his name is Richard Sandler, and he did a movie back in 1999 called The Gods of Times Square. And I don't know if I've talked about this on this show, but that is an extraordinary movie. It's really, it's filmed from 94 to about 98. And it shows, it's really about, religious proselytizers in the Times Square district in New York City.
Okay.
But at the same time, in the background, the old Times Square is coming down and the Disney Times Square is going up. So you kind of got two fronts in this documentary. And he also did a documentary at the same time. He used to have to travel from his East Village apartment to Times Square, so he had his camera with him always. So when he would go into the subway, he would shoot things down there as well. So he made a great subway documentary called Sway. He just has an eye, and his movies have such a feel all their own. I mean, there's no narration, there's no nothing. It's just shots and people proselytizing to the camera, and it's just it's amazing. It's worth checking out. It's available. It's out there on DVD. Both of those. And I also wanted to mention, where is it here? I also wanted to mention a movie that came out in 2003 by Tom Anderson called Los Angeles Plays Itself.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically a film lover's dream. It's a movie about how Los Angeles is portrayed in movies. And at the same time, how closely they get the idea of Los Angeles down, or what they play up and what they play down, and it's also a documentary about his memories of growing up in Los Angeles as well. I don't know how hard the movie is to find, because it literally has, it must have clips from 150 movies in it, and I mean,
yeah.
You've talked
about it before with us on the show, actually.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's out there, but,
you don't know whether it's available?
I've seen it, through a download on the computer, but it might be out there, like, on bootlegs or something like that, but I'm not really even sure that it's ever gotten an official release, because I would imagine, there would be a hell of a lot of money to pay for all those clips. I mean,
right,
he really
right.
does have a lot of clips in it.
Well, speaking of documentaries coming out, by the way, one that we haven't mentioned, it's kind of a documentary, it's more an instructional film, is the Zinc Oxide and You segment in Kentucky Fried Movie. That's
right.
Great.
What about the Battle of Algiers count as a documentary?
Well,
no.
I mean,
I
mean, that's definitely a narrative film, but that movie takes a lot from documentary, obviously. That it retains a lot of its power from its kind of documentary feel,
yeah.
its style.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true guerrilla filmmaking, really,
yeah.
that film. This year, actually, because the another high-profile documentary from years ago that we've covered on the show with the director was the Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired.
Mm-hmm.
And the director of that, Marina Zinovich, she's done a follow-up, and that comes out this fall. So I think we're probably going to see that screen at something like Venice.
Mm-hmm.
So we should get word on that sometime soon.
Maybe at New York. Maybe they'll play that at the New York Film Festival as well.
Yeah.
And that would make sense.
They did a Polanski documentary. I think Laurent Bouzereau did one that played at Cannes, and that didn't get very good notices.
Mm.
And then Room 237, which is obviously the meaning of The Shining.
Don't forget the Camden 28.
Now, Laurent Bouzereau, he's the guy that does a lot of, doesn't he do a lot of like extras on
yes.
DVDs
yes,
and so
does,
forth?
Yes.
Like, does a lot of featurettes and stuff, yeah. Sometimes I feel like his featurettes are just so, like, cookie-cutter. They're like, well, first we start off with a picture, and then here we start off with 5 minutes of clips, and then we go into
right.
the first interview, and you can
well,
kind of, like...
Well, I think in terms of his Polanski documentary, the main criticism has been it's a little... He's a little too enamored with his subject
right.
to kind of take a look back, you know, get some perspective on the whole situation.
Uh-huh.
So it plays like more of a fan letter with information that we already know. Yeah.
Mm.
I have
okay.
a documentary that I can't pronounce, but it's about, I saw it in 2002. It's about the French philosopher, oh God, I'll spell his name for you, but I always mess it up. D-E-R-R-I-D-A, Jacques Derrida.
Derrida.
I saw that documentary. I knew nothing about him. I just walked in the theater, and it was one of the most fascinating things I'd ever seen. I knew nothing about him.
What's it called?
It's his name. It's just and it came out. It's by Kirby Dick.
Okay.
And I just never. I read about it. I went to go see it, and it's just a really fascinating film.
Kirby Dick, that has his movie about rape, sexual harassment, and rape in the military right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. The Invisible War.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. And then
a fascinating film. I really loved it.
And then they've announced a Robert Altman documentary too, which should be interesting. Talk about a lot
Who's
of interviews.
That?
I don't know, but talk about a lot of subjects that could be included in that movie.
I mean, boy, that thing could be like 4 hours long. I hope it is 4 hours long. I mean, that could be such a great documentary.
And it'll all be improvised. It's amazing.
Yeah. I got to mention Charles Ferguson, who has mm-hmm. Who's been on the show and
mm-hmm.
With you know, talking about Inside Out, Inside Job, and No End in Sight.
Those are both very, very good films. Really important films too.
He's got a real way about, like, being able to condense a difficult subject down to, you know, down to a manageable, understandable
size. Yeah, and he picked two formidable subjects, those two films
yeah.
to do that with.
Yeah, for sure.
All good choices. Sunday night we'll be doing movie news. Comic-Con is in full swing, and we'll have a lot more news about it by Sunday night.
I hope that be something, we'll be able to find out some stuff about some of these films coming out and books and everything. So
I know they got a Django exhibit.
They got a t-shirt promo going on.
Yeah, they got to Expendables 2. I mean, that's all I care about. Just give me some Expendables 2 news, and I'm happy.
Yeah, of course. I can't wait to see it. I won't lie to you. I'm looking forward to it.
I can't either. I'm not afraid to admit it either. I hope that it's the Cobra of 2012.
You may get your wish. You can't replicate Cobra. You just can't do it. It came at a time where you just can't do it.
The stars aligned. It was kismet. How awful is that movie going to be? Like, how deliciously awful is that going to be? I see that shot of Schwarzenegger in the trailer saying, "I'm back," and I said, "Oh God, this is awful." Awful. Chuck Norris and Van Damme. I cannot wait. I'm going to take my mother.
I can't wait to see it either. I'm looking forward to it big time.
You think it might be a bigger hit than the first one?
Yes. Yeah, actually.
I actually do, because this has everyone's in this one. Everyone.
The only one that's like not in it is Seagal.
Bad movie. Yeah. Okay.
The only one that's not in it is Seagal. But essentially, you could put a statue in the movie and say it's Seagal. So. Like a statue of Buddha or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so that's going to be our show Sunday night, and then we'll be back after that with Jerry, you, me, and Aaron, and Keith are going to do our annual Summer of Roundtable, mm-hmm. Like we do every year. And I'm trying to set up something with Hans Zimmer, obviously related to Dark Knight Rises, so hopefully that'll come to be.
Right, cool.
All right, guys. A good one.
Yep.
Our last interview, Jonathan Coet. Let me tell you about this extraordinary film. It's his new film called Walk Away, Renee. It's available now on the Sundance Now. They have a new Doc Club video on demand channel. You can purchase it there and watch it. It's pretty incredible. And to get a sense of how incredible this film is, just look back, I think 9 years ago, 2003, when he came out of the gate with his first film, a documentary called Tarnation,
mm-hmm.
which chronicled the very emotional relationship between he and his mentally ill mother. Walk Away Renee continues to explore that relationship as he travels cross-country on a road trip with his mother. It's very inventive. It's as raw and as personal as it gets. Think John Cassavetes doing a documentary. I mean, we talk about Cassavetes in this interview, and you'll get a sense of it. So another must-see documentary, our second for the night. And I really, really enjoyed talking to him, so I'm happy to play this interview. I'll play this interview, and after the interview, we'll premiere a piece of film score for Queen of Versailles, which is a new critically acclaimed documentary that's coming out in theaters this summer. Thank you, guys.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
Well, you are obviously being severely over-medicated right now.
I am.
And you need to be able to stand up for yourself and advocate yourself.
I tell you what, since you
I can do it, but you have to do it too.
I will.
Okay.
Ooh, he's a tough one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like a monster.
You premiered a cut of this at Cannes. Was this
yes.
Was that last year?
It was last year. It was in 2011, and I have been sort of living and breathing with this film so much in the past 3 years. That I've really had a difficult time gauging any sort of sense of time, like just the way time has been passing. Like even now in 2012, it's because I've just been so engulfed in it, you know, the movie for so long now. I was having a conversation with somebody today actually, and we were talking about the movie Weekend, that I remember seeing and loving, and he was like, you know, "Oh, you have seen Weekend?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I saw it, you know, last year." He was like, "You mean this year?" I was like, "No, last year, but you know, just to give you," but it was actually this year, but you know, it's whatever, but it's just, it's so, you know, it's weird because when you immerse yourself in something so intensely, your whole sense of time can become very, very askew.
Sure.
That's kind of where I'm at with with the film at the moment, and I'm very, very, very glad that the film is sort of now finally out there. There were a lot of festivals that the film wasn't able to go to because it was simply on the back burner being finished in sort of, you know, the more proper way. But it had appeared at the Cannes Film Festival in a rather respectively half-baked way. And I think it wasn't anybody to blame or anything necessarily. It was just sort of a circumstantial thing. There were sort of time constraints, and sort of a myriad of things. There were a lot of things that I'm really grateful. Well, first off, I'm really grateful that the Cannes Film Festival allowed us to have the opportunity to show it in that sort of, you know, unfinished work in progress form.
Well, this film, just like Tarnation, is so unique, and it's so personal to you. So to kind of follow up on the process of finishing it, how did you? Was there a moment when you knew, okay, it's done, or was it just a question of, okay, I have to let this go?
Oh, that's a really wonderful question. Actually, it was kind of the opposite of what you're saying. Pre-Cannes, it was like, okay, I have to let this go because the hourglass is running out and the film has gotten into the Cannes Film Festival, even though the Cannes Film Festival knew we were going to be sort of tweaking things here and there, very subtle things. But then, you know, for this last hurrah, this last version of it, this final version that's out, that's going to be at Outfest, that was at BAM, it's done, but there's still a small window that says I still have to let this go because it's not quite the film that I think I had envisioned. And that's not to say it's a bad film or to discount the film at all or anything like that. But I think what I mean by that is when you're experientially going through something and you know, like, all the kind of epic stories and sub-stories and all that it can be, all that can be conveyed, just can't be conveyed in a film because, you know, going through an experience like this, kind of, you know, being a kind of perpetual caretaker of somebody that you love, and that whole experience of what that is, I mean, I think I've really succumbed to the fact that you can't, there's just some things you can't transpose cinematically, at least for me. And I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and they were telling me that probably because I'm so immersed in this, that what I'm thinking is not conveying a story, is actually conveying a huge story to other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it's like, mm-hmm. what I'm thinking is sort of at level two, maybe other people are interpreting it as 10 because it's my life and I'm so used to it. So
right.
I think in a lot of ways, with that respect, with this story at this point in 2012, I feel like I may have lost a little perspective. So it's either, you know, either I know, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but anyway, I think you know.
No,
what
I know.
I mean.
I know exactly what you're saying.
And that's
where the audience reaction becomes so valuable, where you can kind
right,
of gauge
right.
what have I achieved here.
Right, right. And is this something I can easily say now is finished and definitive, as much as definitive as you can be with us trying to get a circumstance like this on, you know, into a form that you can express to people with the power of cinema. This film is absolutely a conclusion to Tarnation. You know, there was a long time where I was saying it was a kissing cousin or somebody had said proto sequel, which I liked that term, proto sequel.
That's nice.
I don't know. It's definitely something else.
Well, with these two films, I'm curious to know from you, how do you think the process of assembling these two films has enriched or deepened your relationship to your mother, whom you were close to? You've always been close to.
It's definitely enriched it in tons of ways. It's you know, on one hand, I still, you know, it's only been 8 years since all of this happened, you know, or 2004, I guess, is when it really started. So that,
yeah,
8, 9 years, I don't know, something like that. But so, you know, we were just, I was we were just a fairly, I would say, fairly normal family before all of this, because nothing has ever been sort of normal. But we were, before all of this happened, you know, we were just a family who I think had a story to tell. And I was, you know, even as a kid, I was just telling my son this the other day. I was trying to explain the dynamic of what it was like to sort of grow up with my mom, you know, when I was his age, when I was younger, and always feeling like, even when I was 6, 7 years old, having to sort of overcompensate for some of the behavior that she was doing, you know, and I would try to sort of defend her. Or, you know, as I became older, I think I said, you know, well, she was just a hippie, she took a lot of acid, you know, just trying to like kind of create these weird allusions to, you know, what was really going on. And so there was always this backstory, this way that I felt like I needed to explain everything. And even upon meeting new friends during my formative years, I started to feel like I couldn't edit anything out, because it would eventually become exposed and I would have to sort of explain everything. Yeah. So I think I was becoming exhausted. You know, on one hand, I felt like, oh, you don't owe anybody any explanation about anything. It is what it is. But then after a while, it just occurred to me that that was so a part of my DNA and a part of my upbringing and who I was, you know, reacting to growing up with a mom like this, that I kept talking about it over and over again. It became this dialogue. So that, I think in a lot of ways, that's where Tarnation came out of, and that's where ultimately the conclusion of that came out of with this film. And because now that I've made the film, it's changed things a little bit in that I'm kind of haunted by the idea that I've made both films on one level. Like, on half of me feels sort of perpetually haunted. Like I wake up in the middle of the night. You know, when you're, I don't know if you've gone through this experience, but at night, you know, when you're kind of on the cusp of being half asleep and half awake, you're just about to, you know, go to sleep, you always get these sort of like weird raw epiphanies of things. You sort of see things for what they really are. For me, it's like, it's existential things, like we're all going to die one day, and then it's these films I've made right before I go to sleep at night. And it's sort of, you know, like, yeah, you know, what did I do? Mm-hmm. And I just think about it, and I sort of start thinking back in my mind's eye about the way the films were made, just the exposure of both of us and all of us, and it, you know, gives me butterflies in my stomach. But then on the same token, I know that I think the films are conveying a beautiful message, and I'm sort of willing to make that sacrifice and take the risk, I think, of conveying that message, which is, I think ultimately, I'm hoping people can have more empathy for the mentally ill, in a nutshell.
Yes, yes. Well, I think that anyone that truly appreciates film in any form, and anyone that makes film, I think that's the one major characteristic that distinguishes them. It's a sense of empathy.
Yes.
That's absolutely what I get from your films. But actually, that's part of what I was very curious about, because I, you know, every family has their turmoil and challenges.
Sure.
But, and my dynamics are certainly not the same as yours. But I would think if I were to make a film involving my family, I would be so torn between wanting to show them at their best and wanting to be truthful.
Of course.
Was that a yin and yang for you?
God, yes, absolutely, yeah. And even, you know, and in any, it's weird because, you know, because Walk Away Renee is so similar to Tarnation in some ways, you know, and obviously it's the same subject matter. It kind of goes back and re-paraphrases aspects of what was sort of probably learned in Tarnation. But, before I even made Tarnation, I had acquired only so much footage up to a certain point, and this was even before the kind of tragedy with my mom, travesty with my mom, you know, having overdosed on lithium. Even before that had happened, I knew that I'd wanted to sort of augment the footage that I had acquired up to that point of everybody in my family. And I had even written I wrote two I wrote one screenplay with two different working titles. One was called Lucid, and the other one was called The Day I Disappeared. And they were totally fictitious. It was a totally fictitious screenplay that sort of took the idea of my footage and repurposed it into fictitious circumstances. It was very, it's kind of like an elongated Twilight Zone episode in a lot of ways. I talked about the notion of my mother's mental illness by sort of happening by way of some sort of supernatural occurrence, and it was very out there and weird, and there were a lot of sort of magical realism elements that were going to be thrown in. And then, you know, over the course of time, I just negated that whole idea and began to realize, as I kept dabbling with the footage over time, before I started, like, signing off on what it was going to be, that I needed to sort of surrender to the truth of the footage and just be truthful with all of it, with and you know, with the screenplay, we were going to refer to ourselves as having different names, and it was going to be very challenging, needless to say, to try to take the footage from the past and re-augment it into something totally fictitious. But I think, you know, as I was living with the footage for a while, and of course when my mom had eventually had her had the overdose, and when I realized, you know, at least with Tarnation, that that was going to be the end of that film, or the end of me filming my family at that point, that's when it occurred to me to be truthful and just show everything, and as much as I could. And I think there, you know, believe it or not, there were nuances of things that I felt like I just wasn't able to show for one reason or another, just morally, I guess, in a lot of ways. And then there were a lot of things and situations that I wished that I had a camera on during, because I think it would have lent a more rich outlook onto the whole circumstance.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Walk Away Renee is, in many ways, it's a, I think you've spoken of this, it kind of serves as a bridge between the documentary and the narrative world.
Definitely. It's for sure a transitional film for me. And I was saying before, not too long ago, that I don't think I ever want to make another documentary again. But I think I need to retract that and say that I don't think I ever want to make another personal documentary again, because as of about 4 weeks ago, like a lot of things happen, sometimes they're good and sometimes they're bad. This happened to be pretty spectacular. A new story of a new project just kind of toppled into my lap. I don't want to say what it is just yet, but it's a documentary, and could potentially be just a wondrous biopic slash documentary on somebody that I just really, really love. And it literally came knocking on my door. So, you know, it looks as though I may have one other documentary in the works. Hopefully if everything goes into fruition, and then I'm definitely looking to segue into narrative films just after this.
Well, in terms of narrative, you know, these films that you've made are so intimate and personal and confessional. Do you think you could feel the same level of investment in a narrative?
I think I'll have more. I like not having the sense of control when you're making a documentary, but at the same time, when you don't have that much control, it can often become very chaotic, too, depending on how you're making it. So I think with making narratives, I'm very into the idea of making narratives. Let's just say that much. But I'm really interested in doc hybrids. So I think in any road I go down in terms of filming fictional stories, I might be into the idea of using unknown people or mixing unknown people with you know, with maybe more known people.
Well, you strike me as someone that based on the films, you know, Tarnation and Walk Away Renee, what I've
yeah.
seen of your work, that likes to walk a high wire. and I think of other filmmakers that did that in the narrative structure, and
oh,
I think
yeah.
some of them are your idols. I mean, people like Cassavetes.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think I have never read any press about Cassavetes, but wasn't he notoriously canned? Like, the press weren't fans of his at
right.
some given points. Is that true, or I don't?
I think, not
that that's of any consolation at all. I mean, whatever.
I think he was so raw and personal that people kind of felt assaulted by him. Very often.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I'm a humongous fan of his, and I mean, if I could make an analogy of film of like a filmmakers that I could easily be inspired by, if I were to take like maybe four essential filmmakers and, you know, kind of create a compilation with them of the kinds of movies I'd want to make, it would be somewhere, you know, in the pot that stirred would be, you know, Cassavetes. Maybe a few drops of Lynch by way of, you know, Robert Altman and,
wow,
I don't know, Jodorowsky, I don't know. It could be like a bunch of things, but I'm into pretty real things, you know, and I love seeing, I love seeing truth and reality, but I also love seeing mystical, strange things happening within that truth.
Right.
You know, I love that kind of cinema.
And it's present in your films. I mean, you found, you know, not to be pretentious about it, but you've kind
yeah.
of found the poetry in your reality.
Oh, thank you.
And I think those filmmakers did the same thing that you're talking about.
Thank you very much.
It
would be lovely to be on a roster with those guys one day, hopefully.
Well, I love your movies, and I cannot thank you enough for giving me time today to talk to you about them.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I'm just sorry to call you like on a whim like this. Let me tell you what's going on. You remember my mother, Renee, right?
Sure.
We're on the road now, and she's lost all of her medication. We were staying at a The reason I'm calling you, Kyle, is to see if there's any way, if there's any strings you would be able to pull to either score me some samples of lithium and Depakote and Seroquel.
I gotta tell you honestly, Donovan, you're really putting me in a tough spot right now. What you're asking me would be a serious risk of malpractice. I just am not in a position to do that.
I understand. I understand, Kyle. And I'm so sorry to call you about this.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Take care.
Yeah.